Good afternoon. We're on the record. It's 15 minutes past 1:00 in the House Judiciary Committee is in session. In attendance, Representative Holmes, Representative Samuels.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Dahlstrom, Representative Rammers, Representative Coghill, Representative Lynn. We're awaiting our friend Representative Grunberg, who I'm sure will be here shortly. We have three bills before the committee. Before we commence, however, I would like to bring to the attention of the committee that notwithstanding the 24-hour rule, this committee only has one bill scheduled for all of next week.
Hey.
And bill requests that have been submitted and are in. And so I don't know whether we have been efficient with our workload or if Senate Finance Committee has been successful with their strategy. I'm not quite sure to which such a posture is due. But we have certainly been diligent in our in executing our workload. We are going to do three pieces of legislation today. The first, at the request of Representative Johansson, is going to be the initiative bill. The second, at the request of Representative Wilson, will be the anatomical gifts bill. And the third, we have our friend Joyce Anderson from Ethics here, and that will be to do the fix-it Representative Lynn bill. And is that the three pieces of business that we have, Nate? Is that correct? Yes. All right, so with that, we're so excited to talk about initiatives. Representative Dahlstrom, the CS for House Bill 355 needs to be introduced.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move the CS for House Bill 355, 25-LS1263/E.
All right.
If you'll introduce yourself for the record, we're so happy to have you before our committee. We like you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sonia Christensen, staff to Representative Johansson. Thanks for taking the time to hear this bill today. There are two changes to the CS, and I'll walk through them and then answer any questions. There's also a few folks online and in the audience to answer questions. First change on page 2, line 10, changes the reporting agency from Division of Elections to Alaska Public Offices Commission. This was basically the appropriate reporting agency to put this language in, seeing that Division of Elections was not set up for reporting and APOC already was. The second change is also page 2. It deleted lines 30 and 31, and that makes the section on reporting, the deadlines for reporting, consistent with all those other reporting requirements that are already enforced by APOC. So it made everything basically streamlined. That's all I have. I'll answer any questions.
Okay, and members should have different. It's a different bill. So, if I recollect, there was a question that Representative Samuels had about a person versus an individual or something to that effect. And the concern that I had was that if a registered voter in Alaska who is a citizen in good standing applies for to run for an elected office, that's a person, until they withdraw from an election cycle. But the for the record, the concern that I had was that an initiative, until the ballots or until the signatures are collected, isn't necessarily a thing. It is not an entity unto itself. And did we do anything to address that particular concern in this piece of legislation? I don't think that we did, but I'm asking you.
For that section, we left it the same. The sponsor felt that it was important for the people to, if someone or a group of people were going to spend more than $500 to influence something that could be a ballot initiative, it's the intent of the sponsor for the people of Alaska to know that.
Okay. And the members should know that we have Gail Fanumi, if I'm probably not pronouncing her name correctly. Are you here, Gail? Did I chop up your name? I'm sorry. Is here if you're available for questions. Do you want to come up? I think you're the only person to testify on this. Do you want to come up, Gail, sit with Sonia? And I'd like to pose that question to you a little bit. Sonia, I'm not sure whether there's going to be enough momentum behind the House version of this bill to make it through both sides of the building. It's hard to call that, you know, at this time of year. It depends on what catches fire and what doesn't. And the bill sponsor indicated that if this piece of legislation did not succeed this year, that he would then be working on it in the interim. It is the intent of the chair, you know, to try and move this bill, although I have my own reservations about it. And I would encourage you to flesh out and address that consideration for the apparently the narrow constituency that I represent, which is that is a bill something, is an initiative something before it's when it can see, when it, I don't want to use that kind of language. When a concept is first considered by the prime sponsors, is it an entity? And maybe this is a question for you, Gail, to refresh us with current statute. Is it an entity? At what time does it become an entity? You have to collect 100 qualified 100 signatures of registered voters and a cashier's check for $100 and submit it to the lieutenant governor to then have the booklets issued to you, at which time there's generally a press release and that there's initiative that's out in the public domain with signatures that may or may not be be acquired by the prime sponsors. But at what point does the concept become an entity, a real thing, as opposed to any one of us who could sign up for elected office, and as soon as we're citizens in good standing, we're registered voters, as soon as we sign up for any office, from the municipal level all the way up to the federal level, we are a candidate and we're subject to all the APOC and ethics requirements. But what about an idea for an initiative? I think that's my question for you. Or Sonia.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if I would be right.
Would you introduce yourself?
Oh, sorry. Gail Fanumi from the Division of Elections. Mm-hmm. The division considers an initiative. The first thing you described, 100 signatures, $100 application, an initiative application.
Okay.
If that application is then meets requirements of statutes, then it moves on to becoming, to be known as an initiative petition. Whether or not that is an entity or a thing, I think that might be more of a legal question from somebody from the Department of Law or perhaps from the Alaska Public Offices Commission. I don't know if Brooke Miles is online available to answer that.
Brooke is retired.
Oh, she did? Oh.
I think yeah, her. Miss Brooke. Representative Samuels?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's simply a policy call. It becomes an entity when we say it becomes an entity.
Mm-hmm.
And if we want disclosure on day one, then that's what the law we make. And if we want disclosure after it passes, I mean, if I collect money as an individual candidate, I filed to run for office on June 1st, and I collect $300, or let's say $5,300 from above the limit, and then I withdraw, I still have to tell who gave me the money, even though I withdrew from the race and sent the money back.
Right.
And there's no expenses, no anything. I still have to say who gave me money even to run. Somebody tried to influence public policy, and they had to put their name on the sheet. So I think it's Division of Elections will do what we tell them to do. I mean, I would assume that.
Hence my objection, Representative Samuels, to precisely that, but I really felt it was the will of the committee to do otherwise and to forward this bill on. But that is precisely my objection, is the freedom of speech element. And your argument, I gather, would be that you can be free speech as much as you want as long as you disclose whom is affording the free speech. Not to put words in your mouth, but
in a nutshell, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Notwithstanding that, I would encourage the bill sponsor, if this, if House Bill 355 does not become law, to more thoroughly address this issue in public policy. And what are the wishes of the bill sponsor? And on that point, we'll have to agree to disagree, as they say around this bill. And then, Representative Simmons, you had another concern about a person versus an individual or somewhere along those lines. Has that been resolved, or do you wish to not address that at this time?
Mr. Chairman, there are several amendments going to be offered. I believe that Representative Johansson and I will be happy to put my name on them for the debate. And if Ms. Christensen can walk us through, I'll do those. And then I have two of my own. And when I get to that point, I've got a couple different legal opinions on the constitutionality from the U.S. Supreme Court on how they look at candidates and how they look at initiatives or ballot measures of some kind in other jurisdictions. So I can do that now, or you can.
And we also have Mr. Bullard on the phone from Ledge Legal, and Chris Ellingson is available with APOC online to answer those questions. So at this point, if the committee is comfortable, if we don't have any more questions, direct questions for Sonia or for Gail, we can move to amendments. Is there any objection to that? Okay. I don't know that I have those. Do I have those in front of me?
Oh, are they? Are they connected to the legal opinion?
Can we take it at ease for just one second?
Yeah, we'll go taking it at ease. It's 128. Representative Samuel.
Thank you, Chairman. I will move amendment number one, which is E.3 Bullard.
E.3?
E.3. By Representative Samuels.
I'll object. We can hear.
Coghill objects. Holmes objects.
I get the feeling a lot of people are going to object.
Wow.
Mr. Chairman, this would prohibit expenditures for any out-of-state entity from weighing in on a ballot measure. It's pretty much as simple as that. And I could talk to you. There's a couple of legal briefs that should be in your packet, and the way I've distilled them down in my non-lawyer brain here, they say that there are problems with a particular source, saying that a particular source, including a corporation, cannot contribute. Is putting limits on there is more acceptable in a couple different cases there, and disclosure is the way that a lot of other entities have gotten around the inability to say we don't want out-of-state people or certain entities, corporate people, unions, whatever the issue is, that the full disclosure has been the way that a lot of people have gotten around that. And I know at the last meeting, Representative Gruenberg, or actually, no, and it was a reporter, asked a question on if, for instance, a gas tax bill or an oil tax bill is coming on there and an oil company doesn't add trying to influence a piece of legislation, does that become reportable and whatnot? And so you kind of go down a slope on if it was a ballot initiative and corporations were running ads on television, even though if it was paid for by XYZ Corporation, can you limit that? And that is not the purpose of amendment number one. The purpose of amendment number one is if, as an organization is formed to either fight or defend a ballot measure, that when that organization gets money, that they can't get money from the out-of-state sources. So if it's the citizens, they cannot get money. So citizens in favor of ballot measure three, that organization, which is going to become the entity that buys ads and bumper stickers and TV and radio ads and all this stuff that go along with no matter which side of the issue they're on, that entity could not get money from out-of-state sources. If a corporate entity or a private citizen wanted to run ads on their own, the Supreme Court has pretty much said you can't really stop that.
Representative Samuels, the last time that we took up House Bill 355, we did the ballot initiative for small children and dogs.
Yes.
What is the hypothetical initiative that?
People that love beautiful flowers opposed to ballot
measure
number
people.
Three.
Jim Holm is going to be very happy that we're taking up this initiative. So the out-of-state entities that are supportive or against beautiful flowers, they're powerful and big, could not contribute money in the form of what? Because they clearly, with their rights, they still can create their own 501c6 and come on the air and influence in that regard. What precisely are they prohibited from doing with E.3, with contributing money for the collection of signatures, with putting money behind the specific support initiative group or against the specific initiative group?
Mr. Chairman, support of or in opposition to ballot initiatives.
How can anything that be constitutional?
Well, I think that Amendment Number 1 is problematic, but I wanted to start the debate. I see not actually, Mr. Chairman, I see the problem actually is what becomes out of state actually is a more practical problem. Is ConocoPhillips an in-state corporation? Is the Sierra Club an in-state entity? They both, I assume, have offices here. And so in-state, you would simply open up buy a business license or something to do that. So
may I return to my issue and to try and find some common ground on the beautiful flowers hypothesis, which is, can we prohibit out-of-state entities from contributing money for the collection of signatures, which would go directly, I think, to one of your concerns, and doesn't necessarily step all over the Constitution in the process.
Mr. Chairman, I'll withdraw Amendment Number 1.
I liked Amendment Number 1.
Which leads us directly, however, to Amendment Number 2.
Okay.
Amendment Number 2 is marked E.4, Bullard.
I like Amendment Number 2 better. Amendment Number 2 is before us. Representative Gruenberg is in attendance. Is there an objection?
Object.
Almost.
Go with me here.
Talk to you.
Representative Holmes objects to Amendment Number 2.
This is
E.4 is Amendment Number 2.
Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I stated in the beginning here, the couple different legal briefs I got, which both cited different U.S. Supreme Court cases, so if we got 10 lawyers, we'd have 10 different opinions here. But generally, they said as particular sources were problematic. And the difference between an individual running for office and a ballot measure was that the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, has found that by limiting contributions to individuals, you stay away not only from corruption but the appearance of corruption. But if you're debating an idea, that limiting a particular source of money is not the same as to an individual candidate. And they differentiate between me being only able to get $500 from an individual and a corporation being able to give limitless money, essentially, to a ballot initiative. So what Amendment 2 does is it stays away from the particular sources. However, we go to full disclosure and the limits. And the disclosure is that the entities can only give as if they were giving to a candidate. And it gets away from, I would say, being over the edge, constitutionally speaking. The disclosure, I think, is fully, the full disclosure is, I think, in both of the legal opinions has been.
So, question. Fully,
and I'll get to your point, if I could, Mr. Chairman. And quite frankly, I'll go back to your comment. We'd have to agree to disagree. I think the minute you spend a dollar, you go up to some guy that's standing in front of REI, and you give him a dollar to get a signature, I want to know who gave that dollar to try to influence public policy in Alaska. And I think we would just disagree on that. It's not just post-signatures. It is from day one until the election takes place, who is trying to influence the policy of the people of the state of Alaska. That I will retain the vote on Amendment Number 2.
Representative Holmes, and then I have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's an exception to this $500 a year in political campaigns in the form of I can contribute unlimited amounts to my own campaign.
Where's that?
No, I'm saying when you and I run for office, Mr. Chairman, you and I, if we were so inclined, could give $100,000 to our own campaign. We can self-finance if I had $100,000 to give, but there's an unlimited, you're not subject to the $500 limit for your own campaign. Is there any sort of exception here for the person who, or members of the group who originally put the idea forth?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, the idea is to have the same limit. So if I were a wealthy individual and I wanted to flat out just hire people to do this on my own, actually, I still think your $500 limit should apply. You go the opposite way rather than pushing the candidate forward. If you're trying to push the idea forward, the limit, I think, should remain the same on the idea.
Representative Samuels, let me pose the question to you in this way. First of all, Dr. Anthony Scott, who said he would agree to disagree. I didn't coin that. I didn't coin that phrase, and you know it. My first year in the legislature, serving on the State Affairs Committee with Representative Lynn, we took up a bill for on behalf of the Division of Elections, and I questioned why somebody should be paid a dollar per signature in the first place. And it was the Lieutenant Governor's Office in the Division of Elections. That argued that you had to be able to pay somebody something. And I don't want to. I don't remember, nor do I want to defend their argument of why you had to maintain the dollar per signature rule. But if that's the rule, then this amendment would make it very difficult to finance the collection of signatures. And the collection of signatures is an entirely different process than the advocacy or its opposite or its opposition to a particular bill. So the way that I read amendment number 2, and I have not read it carefully, does it apply to both elements of an initiative, both the effort to collect signatures as well as the effort to advertise for or against the initiative?
Mr. Chairman, yes. And once again, if I pay a campaign volunteer, if I have a niece or a nephew hang door hangers around the neighborhood for me and everything, and I choose to pay them, I have to tell everybody in the world where I got the money and who I paid it to. I'm trying to influence public policy for my niece Sally to go out and hang things, where the money came from, and it doesn't matter if I got elected or not, or withdrew after I withdrew from the race after she went and hanged the door hangers, where I got the money, where I spent the money trying to influence public policy. So
you would be, Representative Samuels, you would be thwarting the will of the Fairbanks North Star Borough right now, who has put $150,000 aside to go out and influence public policy by hiring presumably a statewide coordinator and collecting signatures to raise the property tax program. So the
taxpayers of Fairbanks can thank me.
Right, yeah. So the yes, I appreciate your editorial comments, but in that case, my borough would be limited to $500 worth of participation on both sides, both on collecting the signatures and advocating for the issue. Is that correct?
Let me read this very carefully.
It is the entity. The Fairbanks North Star Borough would be the entity in this case. Mm-hmm.
This is an individual.
Representative Holt?
Mr. Chairman, it says an individual on page 2, section 5, talking about the contribution limits. I'm not sure that a borough could actually contribute at all. I think it would, my quick reading of this is that it would limit the same way a borough couldn't contribute to my or your political campaign. I don't think that a borough under this would be able to contribute anything, or a corporation for that matter.
Representative Samuels.
Thank you. And if the Fairbanks North Star Borough, the way that I intended this, if the Fairbanks North Star Borough wants to run their own campaign and not give money to a third-party entity, the People for Beautiful Flowers campaign, which is most campaigns, Croft was trust the people or let the people vote or whatever they call themselves. Entities form the group. They collect the money from all of these third parties. If the Fairbanks North Star Borough, the intent is, wishes to go out on their own with advertisements saying paid for by the Fairbanks North Star Borough, then I don't have a problem with that. If the Fairbanks North Star Borough is hiding behind the skirts of the Fairbanks or the People for Beautiful Flowers Coalition, and they're getting all the money, and it's the government who is giving the money in there, we want to know where they gave it from and limit the money.
But what if I am People for Beautiful Flowers and I want to fund $100,000 because there's necessary expenses because of Bill Williams from Ketchikan, who I'm grateful to. There's a certain amount of requisite travel. Generally, there is a signature coordinator, and then there is the dollar per signature cost of collecting signatures. We anticipate having a very lively general election across the country and in the state of Alaska, so we're probably going to have a record turnout for the Clinton/Obama versus McCain general election in November. 10% of those that vote in the general election are going to be required for signature gathering to put something on the ballot, which could be, last time it was 340,000 people voted, so it required 34,000 signatures, and only 82-83% of signature gathered are generally good signatures, so 34,000 times 20%, that's close to 40,000 signatures. The Trust the People they gathered 47,000 signatures, 90 days gathered 46,000 signatures. You add in the dollar per signature plus the travel plus a coordinator, and I'll just go on the record saying that I didn't get any money for my signatures and I was the coordinator. And if my aspirations are to do a 70-day legislative session, and I'm not planning on it, Representative Cotton.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Then am I prohibited from self-funding that? And to echo the same concerns that Representative Holmes raised, I could go out and spend $1 million on my House seat if I chose to. Am I prohibited from self-funding as an individual who is an Alaskan who wants to avail myself of the initiative process? Have you prohibited me from doing so?
Mr. Chairman, I think not. On page 2, it says $500 a year to an individual group or non-group entity. So if Jay Ramirez wanted to run ads and pay people as just Jay Ramirez, then that's fine. If you start collecting money from other people or you want to give your money to somebody and hide behind it, then you cannot do that.
But line 4, Section B says, oh, we have somebody who can help us with this. Who is Alpheus?
Alpheus Bullard, he's the director.
Mr. Bullard, are you with us?
Can you hear me?
We can. Please help us.
Yeah, help me with my own amendment here.
Through the chair, what is the specific question,
please? Self-funding. Start with self-funding.
I think the question is self-funding of either side of the initiative process, putting an initiative on the ballot, and once it's on the ballot, it's advocacy or a person's opposition.
If you yourself were to use your own resources in support or in opposition to a ballot initiative, this section B on page 2 of what you're calling amendment number 2, E4, would not operate to restrict you.
It would, or you would still be allowed to do it, or you would not be allowed?
You would be allowed to do it.
And what if an individual wanted to collect the signatures to put a ballot initiative on the ballot?
If the individual was the one collecting the signatures, one of the initiative committee sponsors?
Yes.
And they were using their own funds?
Yes.
Not contributing them to an individual group or non-group entity, they would be in the clear.
But what if Representative Holmes wanted to contribute $500 to the effort? How would she be able to do it if there's not an entity established, if it's just Jay Ramirez that is collecting the signatures or funding the effort. As soon as she wants to contribute, then isn't Jay Ramirez also compromised because there has to be an entity?
I'm not entirely sure I understand your question. She could contribute $500.
To whom?
To Jay Ramirez. That would be acceptable under this provision of the amendment.
But there are three prime sponsors to an initiative that's presently in statute. And so who would Representative Holmes to be able to contribute to? To any of the three prime sponsors?
To all three?
I'm sorry, Representative Holmes?
Or to all three. Could I contribute, Mr. Chairman, to all three of the prime sponsors, each of them $500 each?
I think, through the chair, Representative Holmes, I think that you would be held to contributing only $500 a year. To any one of the initiative sponsors, because together they are the initiative committee, which is a group. I think the easiest way to understand this particular amendment, I'm not speaking of functionality, is that this amendment matches what is provided for candidates under our election code in Title 15, Chapter 13, and makes it exactly the same for ballot initiatives.
Okay, that's helpful for me. I don't like this amendment. Are there any other questions for Mr. Bullard?
Yeah.
Mr. Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was hoping Mr. Bullard could help us out with corporations and whether or not corporations, companies, would be able to either contribute to a committee or whether they would be able, and if not, whether they can just go out and fund their own commercials without going through an entity.
Through the chair, within the context of this particular amendment?
Correct.
This amendment would limit that corporation, if you look down to Section 6 on page 2 of E4, but $1,000.
So, Mr. Chairman, a corporation is a non-group entity?
Through the chair, the relevant section is 1513070, which Section 6 also modifies.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, now I'm very confused because here they're saying non-group entities can contribute up to $1,000 to a candidate, but corporations are strictly prohibited, I thought, in this state from contributing to candidates. So I would think that Section 6, I can't imagine that a non-group entity includes a corporation.
Mr. Bullard, I'm sure you heard Representative Holmes, and without offending you as the drafter, I find this amendment to be dense in its construction. And so I wonder if I might ask Representative Samuels, what was the intent of this amendment as you requested it of the drafting? What were you trying to accomplish?
The intent. First of all, the intent of the legislation and the amendment.
To kill the initiative process?
No, I want to know where the money comes from, and I want to limit the amount of money that flows into the initiative process. So whether it be the Defenders of Wildlife, who are going to be very active and are very active right now in our hometown, in my hometown, or whether it be ExxonMobil trying to kill a reserves tax. I want to know where the money comes from, and I want to have less money flowing into the process. The initiative process, you know, if you're willing to put the work into it, I want to have it transparent, and I want to have small amounts of money so that the best bumper sticker is not setting public policy for the people of Alaska. And I'm willing to withdraw amendment number 2, which will lead us directly to amendment number 3.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
So amendment
however,
yes?
The issue will not go away.
Agreed.
If the bill starts to move, you will see it on the floor.
So amendment number 2 is?
I withdraw amendment number 2.
Amendment number two is withdrawn, and amendment number three is E.2?
E.2. And I would...
Do I have E.2?
I will move amendment number three, and I will ask Ms. Christensen to walk through it since it's already about half an hour ago.
I'll object, Mr. Chairman.
Amendment number three has been moved. Representative Holmes has objected. Sonny, would you take us through what amendment number three does?
Sure. For the record, again, Sonia Christensen, staff to Representative Johansson. I'd also like to clarify that it's not the intent of this legislation to destroy the initiative process in any way. We just want to make it more clear. Amendment number three is simply a... The way that it currently reads in the CS, it's the language is redundant, and amendment number three simply makes the correction. And I believe Alpheus or Mr. Bullard from Ledge Legal is online to speak to those language changes.
Okay. Mr. Bullard, I'd ask you to speak to that, but then the other question that I would ask you to speak to is this distinction that I'm still fumbling with a little bit, which is if any one of us at this table want to run for office from a municipal level up to the federal level, and we are registered voters and citizens in good standing, all we have to do is go to the Division of Elections and file, and we're presumably on the ballot and subject to all of the reporting rules, whether below 5,000 or above 5,000. What makes the initiative process unique is that there are at least two phases of it, and arguably there's three phases. The first phase is the 100 signatures, the $100, and getting the notion approved by the lieutenant governor, passing through the Department of Law is the first piece. Second piece is the collection of the signatures, which requires travel and just as a matter of course paying $1 per signature for the collection of the signatures. And then the third piece is its advocacy or its opposition. And so when I see these amendments come before us, I need to know which pieces of this process they apply to. And it may be the intention of the maker of the amendment to apply to all of them. But I would then ask the same question of amendment number three. When it says a person making expenditures in support of or in opposition to an initiative, whether collecting signatures is meant to be in support of or whether it's just the mechanics of putting it before the people. Representative Samuels.
I cannot imagine collecting signatures for an initiative that you are in opposition to. Unless you're in it just to make the $2 a signature, in which case it's just a commercial deal. But I still want to know, somebody paying somebody to collect signatures for an initiative wants the initiative to pass.
Okay.
So I would say wholeheartedly, open and transparent.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill.
Not unlike the initiative process, I have had to go through the process where I get my name on one ballot only to get my name on another ballot. I have to go through a primary process. And that requires some pretty extensive reporting, too. And that's not unlike gathering signatures in many ways. For analogy's sake.
Okay. And I can live with amendment number three, just Representative Grimberg.
Mr. Bullard, to the chair, have you had a chance, obviously you drafted amendment number E2, so you've had a chance to see it. Do you have it in front of you, Alpheus?
I do.
Okay. Do you have a legal opinion as to whether it's constitutional?
Through the chair, yes. I believe that this E2 is a constitutional amendment.
Do you happen to have a written opinion one way or the other on that?
On amendment E2 through the chair? No, I do not.
Okay. But you don't think that the McIntyre, I think it's the McIntyre case, right? That doesn't prohibit it. I mean, because people don't have a right to be secret about this. There's no problem in making them disclose their names.
Through the chair, if I may answer Representative Grimberg, I believe that the $500 limit for individuals precludes any sort of constitutional problem that the McIntyre decision might give rise to.
Through the chair, why?
McIntyre was a case that dealt with an anonymous pamphleteer who was distributing leaflets about a school board election. When we talk about ballot initiatives, this is a much larger situation, and distributing leaflets to do with a matter of very local concern is a different sort of speech than the sort of speech dealing with this ballot initiative.
And this, if I may follow up, Mr. Chair, this amendment uses both persons in line 3, individual in line 5, person in line 8, and individual line 9. Is there a difference in those terms, and should we make them all the same? Why do we have two different terms?
Through the chair. Right now, under existing law, under 1513.050, persons other than individuals, that would be corporations, some groups, non-groups, are required to report even before they make an expenditure in support or opposition to a ballot initiative. This merely adds in individuals making expenditures exceeding $500.
I see. I see. So let me ask you, would individuals be within the definition of persons? I'm trying to see if this would cause any confusion. You say in addition to those persons required to register. Are individuals required to register currently?
Through the chair, they are not. The language here in this amendment reflects 1513.050, which provides that a person other than an individual.
I see.
Representative
Holmes. Okay, thank you.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My questions are actually following up on Representative Grinberg. So I understand why person is used where it is, because it includes non-group entities and others. But when Section A seems to then only add a new requirement for individuals, so does this mean that if, excuse me, if a corporation or if a non-group entity is making independent expenditures in excess of $500 in support or in opposition, they are not required to register under this? If a PAC or, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, or a corporation, I think is probably the best example, if a corporation were going on, if ExxonMobil or a union or any, say any group, were to be spending in excess of $500 in support or opposition, and they're doing it on their own, they're not going through the initiative committee, because this section only applies to individuals, I'd say they're off the hook and don't need to register. Is that, am I correct, that there's no reporting requirement then for corporations?
Through the chair. The reporting requirements, or the registration requirements, let's speak to those first, already exist in law, again, at 1513.050, and that corporation, as is your hypothetical, is required to register right now. This amendment does not change that. They must register even before they make an expenditure.
Okay, are there other questions on amendment number 3? Is the objection maintained? I assume it is.
I'll withdraw my objection.
Okay, the objection is withdrawn. Amendment number 3 is
I'm okay.
You're okay? Amendment number 3 has passed. We have the bill back before us. I don't believe we have anybody else online anywhere in the world that wants to testify on this bill. Public testimony is closed.
We have a group entity that wants to testify.
House Bill 355 is before us. Representative Dulles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wish to move the CS for House Bill number 355, version /E, with any attached physical notes, with amendment number three, and individual recommendations.
Thank you.
Do you want comments on the bill?
Pardon me?
Just kidding.
HB 355 has passed, and I will ask that you carry back to the bill sponsor this segregation of the two halves of the process. I understand the reporting, but it's really two distinct processes, and I am such an advocate of direct democracy that I hate to see that element curbed, even though I appreciate the maker of the amendment and the bill sponsor in wanting disclosure of who's supporting. But we ought to be able to protect the rights of direct democracy and still meet the needs of full disclosure.
May I quote you on that, on a bill that's going to be on the floor tomorrow?
No.
Thank you. And the flip side of that is the money to get the signatures is just as important to the public in the process as the money to buy the bumper stickers afterwards. If ExxonMobil is out there trying to get signatures to do something for a tax, it's not just the campaign afterwards. It's who got the money and who's trying to push something through the process. I wonder who it is.
Yes, Representative Holmes, editorial content on
on the bill. We've already passed out of committee. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just also urge the bill sponsor to be just go back and triple check that we haven't accidentally created any loophole whereby, for instance, corporations or unions or other groups like that could go out and spend money in a way that an individual could not and avoid having to report. So I would just ask you to triple check that's the case. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. And as the chair of the committee, I don't like this bill, but I felt that I didn't represent the majority point of view of the committee and thought it was appropriate.
I'm just going to pass it out.
Right. Okay. So
thank you,
on. Thank you, Sonia. It was a pleasure to have you. You're always welcome. You always are welcome. you're terrific. We like you very much. On to a really terrific bill. With Representative Wilson's office this is anatomical gifts. And if you'll introduce yourself for the record, and then I will to just introduce yourself for the record. This is a very compelling subject.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Becky Rooney. I'm staff to Representative Peggy Wilson, and I'm happy to be here to speak for her on behalf of HB 420, which is anatomical gift bill. It's pretty long. It's a little bit daunting, but basically it's a cleanup bill that updates the Alaska statutes regarding organ donation. There's a piece of model legislation called the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act that serves to harmonize organ and tissue donation laws in all 50 states and the federal government. The UAGA has been doing this for over 40 years. Alaskan statutes regarding organ donation are already based on the UAGA. But they are modeled after the last significant update, which was in 1987. HB 420 brings Alaskan statutes in line with the most recent version, which is the 2008 revised UAGA. The Department of Law, the Department of Health and Social Services, the State Medical Examiner's Office, LIFE, Alaska Donor Services, and representatives of the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws were involved in the development of this bill language to ensure a sound piece of legislation. And so far, everyone has been happy with the results. At this very moment, an estimated 180 Alaskans are in need of life-saving transplant and waiting for a donated organ to become available. Hundreds more are waiting for tissue transplants. Because the bill is basically a realignment of statutes with that 2008 Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, I won't go through all those recommended changes. You have a section in front of you that attempts to explain them. If you have specific questions, we have a great panel of experts, both online and here in person, to answer them. I thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of this bill.
Thank you, Becky. We're so happy to have you before us. Representative Gruber, just before you get going, let me tell you who is with us. Just
sure.
So we have testifying here in the room for questions. We have our friend Jay Butler, the Chief Medical Officer. It's so nice to have you back with us, sir. And then Deborah Baer is also available with the Department of Law. And then on the telephone, we have Chris Badillo Moreno from Life Alaska. And then Bruce Zalraitis from also with Life Alaska. And then Kim McGee speaking on her own behalf, and Mike Garrity, who is the Uniform Law Commissioner, the kind of the universe of people that we have that wish to speak on this. Representative Grunberg, your question is for whom?
Well, it's really, I guess, for Ms. Baer.
Ms. Baer, if you'll introduce yourself for the record, and Doctor, if you'll do the same, we appreciate it.
My name is Deborah Baer, and I'm employed by the Alaska Department of Law. I'm also a Uniform Law Commissioner for the state of Alaska, and I'm pleased to recommend the adoption of the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act today.
Through the chair, Ms. Baer, this is an act that is intended to retain the uniformity of our current legislation, right?
It's what it would do is bring us in line with, there's over 20 states that already have the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act. There is pending before 16 state legislatures as well. What it does is complementary to the laws that is on the books right now that this legislature adopted maybe 4 or 5 years ago on healthcare decisions that Representative Weirach spent a lot of time with, and it's complementary to that act as well.
Well, my question is, if we pass this, will this destroy the uniformity of the act? Have you conferred with the other commissioners to determine whether this bill might take us out of uniformity?
Yes, through the chair, I have consulted with the national organization, and this bill is consistent with what other states are doing. And it's very important, especially in anatomical gifts, for law to be uniform across the states, because you can have an organ to be donated in one state, the recipient in another state, and family members in a totally different states. And so it's really important that it be uniform, and this complies with that.
If I may, I have this very specific question. Do you have a copy of the bill in front of you?
Yes.
I'd like you to turn to page 15, line 21, please.
Page which?
Page 15, line 21. Please let me know when you got that. And I would ask you if you also have a copy available in front of you there of AS 13.52.055, which is referenced on that line.
13.52.055?
You're right.
Right, I've got it.
Okay. It says, except as provided by AS 13.52.055, which are certain provisions concerning pregnancy. And I'm wondering if the commissioners have carefully examined whether the exception to AS 13.52.055 would destroy the uniformity of the act.
Through the chair, this is a unique provision of Alaska law. It is not in, I'm not aware of any other state having law that is very similar to it. What the what the Uniform Law Commissioners believe is that there are certain decisions that can be reserved for the state, and the decision itself does not destroy the uniformity of how organs are donated. We don't get into the basic decisions such as zeros on pregnancy. It's not something we would defer to local jurisdiction on. Mm-hmm.
The commissioners would defer.
Right.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for not delving too deeply into that issue. That's good. Other questions? Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On these gifts, what percent of these anatomical gifts go to people who need a major organ, a heart, a lung, a kidney, et cetera, as compared to gifts for elective surgery, maybe perhaps cosmetic surgery and so on?
Through the chair, I would like to suggest Bruce Sanarades from Life Alaska is online. He does this every day of the week, and I think he can give you the most accurate information.
Okay.
Hello, this is Bruce Sanarades. I'm CEO of Life Alaska Donor Services here in Anchorage.
Welcome.
And to answer your question, sir, through the chair, I would say that in an average donation, if a donor was an organ and tissue donor, the organs would be including about four recipients, maybe five on average, and the tissue recipients could amount up to 50 patients from that one donation. So 50 tissue donated and about four or five organs from that one donor.
So,
and I'll just add, in Alaska we have 200 donors a year, of which about 25 of those donors are organ donors, organ and tissue donors combined, and the remainder are tissue donors that do not donate organs.
I'm a little confused, which is nothing new, but when you say tissue donor versus organ donor, I think I know. Could you explain that to me?
I'd be glad to, sir. An organ donor is somebody we describe as somebody who would donate a vascularized organ like the kidney, the liver, the heart for transplant, lungs, pancreas, sometimes small intestine, organs that are vascularized and have a blood supply at the time of donation. A tissue donor would be somebody like the cornea, skin, orthopedic tissues, vessels of the leg sometimes, who donate these tissues following the cessation of the heartbeat or after circulation has ceased. And these tissues can still be donated up to 15 to 24 hours following the cessation of the heartbeat. Organs are donated while the heart is still beating.
I see. And if I may follow up, let me, as long as I have you, and I think I know the answer to this, are any part of an aborted fetus, a feti, used to in your work there at the Life Services?
No, we do not engage in any research or surgery or donation of tissues from fetuses. Nothing before normal birth.
And one last question, if I may. On the tissue donation or other donation, do you charge a fee of any kind, either for the organ donation or for tissue donation? What fees are charged here?
In the same manner, respectfully through the chair, in the same manner that a unit of blood is donated, a fee is charged for processing to the recipient. Life Alaska also charges a fee for the tissue transplant related to the processing charges to acquire the tissue safely, preserve it, and send it to the recipient center.
And I would assume that different tissues, different organs might require different procedures, and so the cost would vary between what might be donated. The processing fee might vary.
That is correct, sir.
And which has the highest processing fee? Which kind of tissue?
In the case of organ donation, organs would have the highest standard acquisition fee, and some tissues would have a lower fee, quite a bit lower.
Thank you. I may have other questions later.
First of all, I'm very grateful for the representative bringing it forward. This is a very near and dear to me because my own grandson was a donor when he died, and they kept him alive for a day and a half, having him prepared. So it's pretty tough. But I think probably the practical problem I saw was the issue between states. Not only was there a travel issue, but there was some of these technical issues, and I suppose that this probably aligns us much better than we are right now. So I think just the timing is probably a big deal here too. You might comment on that. I don't know if that's true, but I know there was a big time delay.
Yes, Bruce, would you like to comment on Representative Coghill's question about?
Are you asking Bruce?
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
Bruce,
sir.
Would you comment?
I would say that in the case of organ transplants, especially, we have a very limited time from the time the organ is removed from the donor to the time blood flow is reestablished in the recipient. In the case of a heart, we only have about 6 hours. In the case of a liver, maybe 18 hours. In the case of a kidney, maybe 24 to 30 hours from the interruption of blood flow in the donor to reestablishment in the recipient. So you can see with a heart, we need to have a team here flying back to Seattle, for example, 3 hours, half hour each end driving. The recipient is in the operating room awaiting that heart, donated heart, to be transplanted immediately upon arrival to the University of Washington, for example, or Sacred Heart in Spokane, if it's that hospital.
I guess the question is, the rules of procedure being uniform, are we that out of sync right now, or is this helping in that regard? So I think just as far as a law question goes, how do we sync up now compared to what this is going to bring us into?
Through the chair, this is Deborah Berrigan with the Alaska Department of Law. This is going to dramatically improve the process because it sets up procedures. For example, in with a young child, probably that young child never signed a release, didn't have the capacity. The parents have to do that. And if the parents, and this sets out a procedure for to clearly let the doctor know this is what the family wishes to do and how to do it on a very tight time frame. So yes, it will improve organ donation in the state of Alaska. I'm told that it has saved lives in other states.
A question of curiosity for me, I guess to Bruce, how many people are served? How many organs are your resource? I'm trying to figure out how to ask the question. Are people from Washington the beneficiary? I mean, how does it work? I'm just curious. Would you just give us just a 2-minute?
Yes, sir. Through the chair, I would like to say that the organ donors in Alaska, their organs are then, in most cases, sent to Seattle, where our Alaskan recipients receive their transplants for the most part. There are exceptions, Spokane, San Francisco, Midwest occasionally, but most of the Alaskan patients, and of the 180 patients waiting, approximately 120 of those are kidney patients. And most of the time they'll go to Swedish, Virginia Mason, UW, sometimes Sacred Heart. So they will go to Washington for their transplant procedure, and that's where the organs go. They also might receive an organ from a Washington or Montana donor or Idaho donor, just as much as they could from an Alaskan donor.
And Bruce, are Alaskans kind of standing by in Seattle? I gather Providence, although they do some remarkable things in Anchorage, Providence doesn't offer this suite of services at this time. So when you say there's 180 Alaskans, are they taking up residency in Seattle awaiting organ donors? Is that a good way to understand the process?
Well, most of the kidney patients stay here in Alaska awaiting that phone call. They're on dialysis here locally, many of them in Anchorage. But sometimes a patient who needs a heart transplant, for example, or a lung transplant, is in such an unstable state that they will be waiting for that transplant in Washington, either at the hospital or nearby in a residence facility waiting for the call. So they can be close to the transplanting institution because of their instability from the end-stage organ disease.
And how many organ transplants does Life Alaska Donor Services participate in annually?
Well, we have about 25 donors and about 4 organs per donor on average, so that's about 100 organ transplants.
Lot. Representative Dahlstrom has a question.
Well, just a statement, Mr. Chair. I will just tell you, even in my own community, there's a young boy under age 10, Sean Stockwell, who's been living in Seattle with his mom and sister for the last 2 years waiting for a heart transplant. And his father's working 1 week on and 1 week off, traveling back and forth. I'm also aware of an adult who, I won't state their name, and another child. But Sean's story has been public, so I don't have any problem saying his name, but just That's just in my small area.
Yes, Deborah?
Yeah, through the chair, I just wanted to let you know there's two Alaska families that are online that would like to tell you their stories.
What is Kim McGee, is that right?
Yeah.
All right, and can, with the indulgence committee, if we'll hold questions. So Kim, are you with us?
I am. I'm...
Welcome. We're so happy to have you before the House Judiciary Committee. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Okay. I'm Kim McGee. I am from Anchorage, from Alaska. I am a simultaneous kidney pancreas recipient. And the short history is that I was diabetic for 38 years and developed kidney disease, had kidney disease diminishing to end-stage kidney failure over a number of those years. I was here in Alaska when I received a phone call to come for transplant. But before that, I have to say that I had really excellent medical care here. I was very fortunate. And I knew that I was headed for transplant for a number of years before I was even ready for that. I was able to hold off dialysis because, one, I had really good care, and the other, I was on a really strict diet to try to retain kidney function. I got the phone call to come for transplant after being listed for kidney pancreas transplant. It's a different list than the kidney list. People wait for kidneys for years because I didn't have some other issues and was in, other than kidney failure, I was in pretty good health. Seems kind of bizarre. I was able to be listed for kidney pancreas transplant, and I had a about an 8-month wait. I received a phone call, and I was on an airplane about 2.5 hours later. And my donor was from Washington State, in answer to an earlier question. I think what my message and the reason I wanted to testify about this bill is that transplant is a life-saving operation. When I went to transplant, I knew I was diminishing, and there are days, nights that you go to sleep and you don't really realize, or you do realize, you don't really know that you're going to wake up in the morning because you are so sick. And I knew when I came out of the operating room, despite the fact that I was quite drugged, that I was better. My numbers were better. I was getting better. I got, despite some complications, every day was a better day and got stronger and still am. I guess my point is that transplant is a really critical surgery and saved lives, obviously, daily. The other thing I wanted to address is that people who receive organs are always aware that while they have great fortune in receiving organs, that there are families that lose family members. And so there, we are aware daily, hourly, of the loss of another person, and it isn't something that we gloss over at all. We're grateful for our opportunities and aware of the loss that other families have. Thank you.
Thank you, Kim. A very very moving testimony. Are there questions for Ms. McGee? Kim, thank you for taking time out of your day to be an advocate on behalf of this subject and remembering those that are still awaiting the breath of life. Can we go to Chris Badillo Moreno, please? Chris, are you with us?
Hi. Actually, my name is Sherry. Badillo Moreno, and actually, I'm a volunteer for Life Alaska.
Okay.
I feel very fortunate to say I'm a volunteer, and I'm a donor mom. And my daughter was Sharde Badillo, and she was 17 years old. She was 17 when on November 23rd, 2003, the day before Thanksgiving, the day before Thanksgiving on the way to work, less than 1 mile from home, which is where they say most accidents actually happen. She was on her way to work, and she was coming around the corner, and she lost control of her truck. And bless her heart, she hit the only two big trees in the area, and in an instant, she was gone. She was a senior at Colony High School, and here in the Matsu Valley. She was their football manager. And for someone weighing only 115 pounds and being very young, she set out to win the respect of those big young men. And she worked very hard for 4 years, earning that respect through a lot of hard work, sweat, and tears. And most of those football players were ushers at Chardet's memorial service. And Colony's football coaches were her pallbearers. Chardet was a nationally published poet by the age of 12. And when her sister was in a near-fatal car accident, she had a black bear, no less, on the Glen Highway out here. Chardet wrote a poem entitled Cherish the Moments. And that poem spoke to living each day to the very fullest. Not only each day, but every single moment. It spoke about taking the time, taking every single moment to cherish every single person in your life. Every moment, every minute, because you don't know what's going to happen, when it's going to happen, if it will happen. She spoke about that in that poem and in many of her poems. Because if you have regrets, you don't know if you're going to have that person in your life to make it up to. Ironically, her sister Brittany read that poem at Chardet's service. Chardet lived her life full of passion, and unfortunately, Chardet drove like that. After Chardet was gone, one of her friends broke into her MSN email account, and on her website she had, you know, I like to drive fast, and the fact that I've had 3 accidents is so not the point. You know, that was my Chardet. I miss her more than I can express to any of you today. But, you know, Chardet lives on through tissue donation. Like Bruce said, tissue donation can help up to 50 people. My baby has helped 48 people across this country. Chardet wasn't an organ donation because her death was instant. But she was a heart valve donation. And heart valves, I have learned through my volunteer work with Life Alaska, can be life-saving. They can have helped a baby to live a full life or a young child. She was a skin donor, her skin has been helped in reconstructive surgery. She was a tissue donor and a bone donor. About a year before Chardet passed, she came out to me and said, you know, Mama, I'm going to be famous. People are going to talk about me. They're going to see me in movies. And I remember saying what all moms say, you know, from those of you that are moms and even dads, you know, baby, I know you're going to be. Little did she know, she was absolutely true. You know, or knowing Chardet, she probably did. I've been blessed and fortunate to work with Life Alaska in a lot of educational projects. I've gone with Michael French to a lot of schools here in the Valley and talked to the kids about what happens when they're gone, what happens with their families. It has been my blessing to honor her life through tissue donation. Through her gifts to other people, she lives on through many others. And I will continue my work and my commitment to my daughter. And I do have to tell you that after she was gone, about 2 weeks later, I went to her room. And in her windowsill, going through those little cards that all the kids have in their wallets, you know, in the very center, there was a tissue and organ card that Chardet had signed. It helped to seal in my heart that I knew I had made the right decision. What I want to tell all of you is to tell your families and your kids, let their wishes be known. This act is the right thing to do. Thank you for helping me and letting me to tell you Chardet's story.
Well, God bless you. And
it's my honor.
And your daughter,
Chardet,
and all the people that she has helped. There are people, we don't have a camera in the judiciary room today, but there are people from Dr. Butler to members of the Judiciary Committee that are visibly moved around the table. And we thank you for your testimony, for the selflessness of your daughter, and for your contributions as a volunteer for Life Alaska, and for taking the time out to help us shape public policy here in the state of Alaska to make the way for others. You're very special to be able to shoulder that burden and freshen that loss every time that you speak, and I'm quite moved, and I thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Sherry, Representative Gruenberg has a question for you.
No, not for her, but for other people. I have two questions.
All right. Are there any questions? Thank you so much. I hope that you'll listen as we kind of work on this piece of legislation. And thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate everything that you guys are doing.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Okay. I have two questions, and I think they're mainly for both of you, the doctor and the attorney. They start on page 13. They go on page 13 and 14. And my first question, Mr. Chair, if I may do through the chair all these questions. Subsection F there, and I don't need an answer instantly on this, but before the bill moves from this committee, whether the minor has a constitutional right to determine what to do with their own body.
Representative Gruenberg, the way the act is structured right now, a minor, when they're applying for a driver's license, they need parental consent at the time they're applying for the driver's license. As a part of that, there's a form on the bottom of the card that says, yes, you can decide whether to be an organ donor. A parent does not at that point get involved in the decision about organ donation, but if the parent does not want a child to drive, you don't even reach the issue about organ donation. What this is designed to do is, if at the time a minor has given a consent for organ donation, and later on the parents would wish to an opportunity to revoke it, and the child is still a minor under the custody of the parents, they will respect that parent's decision to revoke or amend the decision.
Through the chair, I understand that's what the bill does. My question is whether it's constitutional, because it seems to me that if the minor has a right to determine what to do with their own body, that the state should provide a method of effectuating that, whether or not the kid gets a driver's license. And, you know, it's a decision whether the parent wants to let the child have a driver's license. But if they wish to make a gift of their body or parts of their body, it seems to me that they may well have a constitutional right to do that. And I'd like you and the other folks to think about that, and even if your jaw is set against it. But I think it's still...
I'm smiling. I'm not...
Oh, you're smiling. Okay, good.
No, that was
particularly, particularly in this particular area where there's, with my due respect to my friend on the right and other people, if there's no fetus involved, I mean, I don't necessarily want to get into that, but that is an important constitutional question that I think needs to be addressed here. And my second question, and Ms. Baer through the chair, I don't need an answer on that instantly, but it's something that I think is a very serious issue, particularly if our kids don't drive any better than we did. I'm sorry, that's not appropriate for me. I apologize. I'm saying that that's gallows humor. The second question is a practical one for the doctor, really. Page 14, lines 5 through 7. That could have very serious practical implications in areas where there's only one doctor, like in the bush. I think we may need an Alaskan exception in that.
What lines was it, please, Representative?
Subsection I on page 14, lines 5 through 7. There may only be one doctor available. Either of you want to comment on that?
Or Bruce may be appropriate. I think Bruce is probably...
Yes, through the chair, I could comment. This is Bruce Salmeratis from Life Alaska. When a death occurs in the rural areas of Alaska, it is our responsibility to arrange for transportation to those areas so that in no condition or circumstance would we expect or want a physician who was involved in the care of that patient and the declaration to be involved in the donation procedure. That would be carried out by members of our team and our colleagues in Seattle. We would arrange for transportation.
Could I inquire?
Representative Grunberg?
Given the vagaries of Alaska weather, et cetera, and the need for quick harvesting or the organ dies, do you foresee that since we're drafting this not just for your organization, for permanency in the state, that we might want to make this a little looser in case, you know, let's say somebody dies out on St. George Island in the Pribilofs, and there happened to be somebody technically who's able to do this there, and you couldn't get in for a while, so that we can save that organ. Should the law provide a little wiggle room in a case of medical necessity?
Bruce Ellenreitis again through the chair. The practicality of organ donation and the reality of the medical conditions to allow for organ donation, again, kidney, liver, heart, pancreas, lungs, would require that any patient who is a candidate for organ donation be transferred to a hospital where procedures and services to maintain that donor before organ donation would take place, ventilation, ICU-type care, which is not available in these rural areas. That person could be a tissue donor, where we mentioned corneas and orthopedic tissue, heart valves, where the heartbeat is not required. There we have time to fly out to those areas if need be, or in reverse, have the transport of that donor to an area where we could do the procedure, coming in from the Pribilofs, for example. But with organ donation, it would not be possible to have that condition established in those rural areas. That's why these patients are transferred for our evaluation to the main hospitals in the state.
Thank you, Bruce. Dr. Butler has a comment, and then I'll remind the committee we've yet to hear from Mike Garrity, the Uniform Law Commissioner.
Yes, for the record, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jay Butler, Chief Medical Officer in the Department of Health and Social Services. And what I'm going to add is just supplemental to what Bruce has already said. The process of organ and tissue harvesting is highly technical and specialized, and primary care physicians out in the rural part of the state will not have training nor the equipment to be able to do that. And really, even considering that kind of thing, I would raise questions about standard of care and whether or not that could really be done in an appropriate manner in those settings.
Through the chair, if I may.
Yes.
I'm very supportive of this bill, and I just wanted you guys to take a look and to see, since, you know, you don't want to have to come back next year when medical science has advanced more or something, if you think that there's anything we can or should do on that, since Alaska is so large and there are not very many physicians, I'd be happy to work with you on that, and hopefully we could take care of that.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I appreciate that, and certainly I think for myself and others also on the line, you know, as we scan the horizon for what are the upcoming scientific developments, we don't see that certainly in the short term, but we would look forward to working with you much further in the future should those developments occur.
Watch too much TV. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome, Representative Grunberg.
And by the way, my comments on the minor's right to choose are just meant to be helpful, too. I will want to take a look at that. That's my only legal question, sir.
We appreciate your sensitivity. Can we hear from Mike Garrity, please, the Uniform Law Commissioner?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Garrity. Good afternoon. I am an attorney in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm also a state law commissioner to the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, which I'll refer to as a national conference just for shorthand. I'm going to review my remarks, just going to truncate these. Some of these issues have already been covered by Bruce and have come up. Just to address briefly the Representative Cockhill's questions about uniformity, the original act was passed back in 1968, and it was quickly enacted by all 50 states and the District of Columbia. What you have before you in House Bill 420 is the revised Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, which was just promulgated by the National Conference in 2006, and as Deborah mentioned, it's already been adopted in, I believe, at least 16, if not more, states, and it's, you know, been introduced. Actually, Bruce has sent me notes, and it's actually 22 states now. So, as legislators, it was something that was just promulgated by the National Conference in 2006 and has already been adopted in 22 states. You can appreciate the alacrity that other legislatures have dealt with this, and you know, we certainly hope that this body does the same thing. And we've had hearings before the Senate on the identical bill in the Senate. So let me just summarize the changes, if I may, briefly. The what is done in this revised act, House Bill 420. First of all, the first person consent to make a donation of an individual's organs, eyes, and tissues has been substantially strengthened to bar others from interfering or trying to amend or revoke that gift. By the same token, if a person has made or entered into a refusal to make a gift and has made that wish known, the act also bars really same people from interfering in that decision if a person makes such a decision not to make a gift. So it's strengthened in that fashion as well. Absent first person consent, however, in where a deceased has not acted to make a refusal or refuse to make a gift, the revised act facilitates gifts by family members and healthcare agents and so on. And this is done by expanding those that can act to make a gift on a person's behalf to include a healthcare agent, a grandchild, for instance, if a grandchild has had a special caring relationship with the donor, and other type of people like that. And it also clarifies in the manner in which that consent must be obtained in those circumstances. Another item is gifts on donor registries and state-issued identification cards are specifically authorized under this new bill. Registries are encouraged and standards are provided for their operations. Many states did not have donor registries when the original act was adopted in 1968, and as many of you know, the state of Alaska, in fact, adopted a uniform state registry here a few years ago, and it's been very, very successful. So, again, the revised act in this bill brings us in line and has changes in the law which to accommodate these changes that have come about, this evolution in transplantation and the uniform gifts. It also, the new bill, provides for the cooperation and coordination between procurement organizations and medical examiners, specifically with regard to procurement from potential donors under the jurisdiction of the medical examiner. We've conferred specifically quite closely with Dr. Butler and with Dr. Falico here in Anchorage and made minor tweaks to the bill to accommodate their needs and wishes, but at the same time we've kept the purpose and the intent of the revised act, and so that we're all signed on to that. Finally, the revised Anatomical Gift Act, House Bill 420, harmonizes federal law with current practices, including the use of advanced medical directives, and that's a fancy term, but primarily we're talking about do not resuscitate orders that are now very common in estate planning and so on. So the revised act, I will say just for the record, has been endorsed by the American Medical Society, the American Bar Association, the American Academy of Ophthalmology, the American Association of Tissue Banks, the American Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgery, the Association of Organ Procurement Organizations, the Federal Health and Human Services Advisory Committee on Organ Transplantation, the Cornea Society, and the iBank Association of America. Again, in conclusion, I'd strongly encourage the committee to act on this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions the members may have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Garrity, for that thorough presentation. Are there questions for Mr. Garrity? I don't see any. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this bill? We would like to, the committee would like to thank particularly the donor recipient, the donor mom, for sharing their very moving and personal stories with us. I'd like to also thank you, Bruce, for taking us through the process. Dr. Butler, Deborah Baer, thank you for your assistance. With that, I'd like to close public testimony. and bring the matter back before the committee. I'm not aware of any amendments. Are there any members who care?
I don't have any today. I would like to take a look at that, the minor issue, the minor's right. And I, if we could give me till tomorrow to do that. If not, it's up to you. It's up to you.
If it's up to me, I would prefer to move the bill today and to contemplate an amendment that we bicycle around to the members, and if it's agreeable, then it could be a
this. This bill does not go goes directly to the floor from here. It's up to you. I'm not
okay. All right. So with that, the chair will entertain a motion to move the bill from committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move House Bill number 420-25-LS1568/A with any attached physical note and individual recommendations.
Thank you. Without objection, the bill moves from committee. I thank the members. And the final piece of business that we're going to take up today is Representative Lynn's State Affairs Committee House Bill 368. Thank you, Dr. Deborah. Thank you very much. Becky, thank you very much for the excellent presentation. We have in attendance with us today Joyce Anderson with Ledge Ethics. We have CS for House Bill 368 needs to be introduced. Representative Cocco? Version O.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll go ahead and move that we have before us the CS for House Bill 368, Judiciary, version O, dated 3/20/08.
We have the O version of 368 before us. And Joyce is here. Do we have anybody else who is here to testify on this bill that we're aware of? No, ma'am? Okay. Joyce, do you want to come? Do you want to come give us your thoughts on,
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Greenberg.
If somebody could just very briefly describe the differences between.
That's what she's going to do.
Oh, she's going to. Sorry.
Joyce.
Committee members and Mr. Chair, my name is Joyce Anderson. I'm the administrator for the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. Basically, what this bill is a cleanup bill from last year regarding House Bill 109, which was the all-encompassing bill regarding ethics, and then also some recommendations that have been made by the Ethics Committee based on their experiences and so forth. And Mr. Chair, I'll just go through section by section real quickly, if that's okay.
Sure.
In section one, what the Ethics Committee has recommended is that language be added for not allowing campaigning during the legislative session, no matter where it is held, whether it is held here in the capital city or in some other municipality. So language has been added to that effect. Section 2 has to do with gifts. Last year, when House Bill 109 was passed, there is a section in there that prohibits gifts from lobbyists to legislative staff. Gifts to legislators from lobbyists it does not apply here because the statute was also changed that would prohibit legislator spouses from being registered lobbyists. So this is really only dealing with legislative staff. Basically, what happened was is there is a what we call an inadvertent consequence because the statute was changed to not allow any gifts from lobbyists to legislative staff. That also prohibited gifts from spouses to staff. So in other words, spouses were not allowed to give a gift to their significant other for birthdays and anniversaries and so forth. And I guess I just want to say when that first became apparent and I started to receive phone calls from legislative staff asking about an interpretation of that particular part of the statute, their first question or their first statement would be, you got to be kidding. And of course, it's real difficult for the ethics office to try to tell someone that that's the way the statute reads. So the ethics committee definitely makes a recommendation that gifts should be allowed from immediate family members to legislative staff. In Section 3, we're making no changes there. We're just dividing up a section that has to do with volunteer services and interns to just make it read better. And that takes care of Section 3 and 4. In Section 5, The Ethics Committee recommended that the publication of summaries of complaint decisions and advisory opinions be changed from semi-annual to annual. And that has been a process that has been in place since before my time when I started in 2001. And so this would just make it consistent with current practice. And please keep in mind that the advisory opinions are put in our advisor newsletter immediately after they're issued. They're also put on a searchable database on the website. And complaint decisions are also put in the advisory newsletter and will soon be on the ethics website as well. The committee also has internal policy in our rules of procedure that any type of decision or an opinion is issued by the ethics office, the press, and other people are notified as well. So that information is almost pretty immediate after it's been issued. Basically, what this publication of summaries deals with is when the publication is actually sent to the House clerk and the Senate secretary, and then it becomes part of the legislative journal. And that's always been done on an annual basis. Section 6 deals with the fine structure. And right now there are two set of fines that are set up within the ethics statute for late filing of disclosures. One is a $2 a day fine up to $100, a maximum of $100 for a late filing. And if the filing is inadvertent, the structure right now is for $25 a day. Basically, what the Ethics Committee is recommending based on the new statutes that came into play and also an advisory opinion issued by the Ethics Committee prior to the statute making it statutory or language making it statutory, legislators and staff now need to file after they either leave service or they leave their employment. And we had a situation where a former legislator refused to file his disclosures after he left office, eventually did file them, was fined. And I won't mention the legislator's name, but I'm hearing the whisper around here. From a certain northern city, let's just say, north of middle of the state. And so the Ethics Committee felt that it was their responsibility and their duty based on statute to forward the, and by the way, the legislator refused to pay the fine. He did file the disclosures. The Ethics Committee felt it was their responsibility to forward that to the AG's office for follow-up. However, since there were two late disclosures and the maximum is $100 each, the total fine would have been $200, and the AG's office does not follow up unless the fine is over $500. It's not worth their time and effort and cost. And so the Ethics Committee also felt, not just because of that reason, but also because it is very important for legislators and staff to file their final day disclosure, so to speak, that they felt that the fine structure, a third section should be added to the fine structure, which would call for a willful refusal to file their disclosures. And they're recommending that the fine structure for this third type of a violation for not filing, or third type of fine structure, excuse me, would be $100 a day, up to a maximum of $2,500 for each day that they're late. And this would put some teeth into the law that requires the disclosure after leaving office or after leaving employment with the legislature. And there was some research done for other states to find out what their fine structure was, and there are some states that have, $10,000 or $5,000 fines and so forth for a willful late filing. So the committee is recommending the $100 a day. And so basically that is the intent. They're a little bit of cleanup language, some recommendations, like I said, based on experiences with the Ethics Committee in dealing with present statute. And I would like to say also that this morning I worked with staff about an amendment, which I'll answer questions on at that point. But are there any questions on the sections that I can answer that are in the version O?
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you. Thanks for being here today. And just a question for my own personal clarification. I think I heard correctly that the way the law is sitting now, the example that was used of the former member that refused to willfully file and then refused to pay the fee,
when that was all said and done, there was nothing you could do about it. General public didn't know anything about it, right? Because you didn't go to the, I mean, the media never picks up on stuff like, I mean, I'm sitting here thinking, I paid a fine one time because I was late on filing, yeah. And it was a $300 fine, and I mean, not that I was happy to write the check out, but on the same hand, I was happy to write the check out because I was late and I was responsible for myself and I sent it in, and I would never have even thought of requesting that that be wiped away because that was my responsibility. But it just seems amazing to me that the media, I don't know, it just...
Mr. Chair, if I may respond, the media did pick up on this, and there was an article in the newspaper in Anchorage as well as in the area where the legislator lives. And your $300 fine was probably through APOC and not through ethics.
It was.
And so there's a different fine structure for an APOC late filing versus ethics. And I believe that by having the three-step fine structure really meets the needs of you, for instance, as a legislator or a staff person, such as an inadvertent late filing of $25 versus, you know, you've already hit the max of 100 and you would be fined 100. And also the Ethics Committee does look at circumstances, extenuating circumstances as well. I mean, we have had legislators, well, let me just mention a legislator who currently isn't here, is in the hospital in Washington State, you know, may not have made a filing of because of extenuating circumstances. This committee is going to look at that, and there would be no fine. The committee would say, you know, there's no reason to fine this person because, first of all, it certainly was inadvertent, but there were other circumstances as well. So by having the three different fine structures, I think what it does is it meets the needs and as I said, put some teeth into the law as well to make sure that individuals do file their disclosures.
I enjoyed, I'll say on behalf of myself, I enjoyed a special circumstance. My campaign treasurer is... cancer treatment as we speak, and we had a situation where I had to extend a filing deadline by a few days. So I appreciate the elasticity, and we're all pleased, Representative Dalton, that your ability to conform has improved. And,
thank you, Mr. Chair. That makes me feel better.
Yeah, I'm sure. Questions for Ms. Anderson, Representative Samuel.
Thank you. In section one only, in several different places, when it says municipality, and I understand the point of it, but what if it's not a municipality?
Representative Samuels, through the chair, there was some discussion. I might have to refer to Dan Wayne. I don't know if he's online. He is the individual who drafted this. But the discussion in the past has been, let's say, for instance, the special session was held. Let me just use the Anchorage area because I'm familiar enough with it. Let's say it was held in Girdwood if there was a facility there. Girdwood is considered part of Anchorage. So in other words, then, because they're part of Anchorage, even though the special session would be held in Girdwood, you still could not hold a fundraiser in Anchorage. So they were encompassing the whole area that particular location would be in versus just, let's say, the Girdwood area, if that answers your question.
Actually, it doesn't. I don't know if municipality is a term of art. Does that include boroughs? The Fairbanks North Star borough is a borough. It is not a municipality. There's only one municipality, and that's the municipality of Anchorage, which includes Girdwood, Eagle River. So if municipality doesn't include Juneau, then you're actually going the wrong direction.
Representative,
if municipality doesn't include it.
Representative Samuels, if the special session is held in the road system and held in the interior, are you trying to compromise the ability of some of us to...
I just don't know what the definition of municipality... There's only one municipality. And the way that I read it, if it's a strict definition, then you're getting even away from having a fundraiser in Juneau.
Representative Samuels, Dan Wayne, the drafter, is going to call in and address.
I think that would be appropriate because I'm not familiar enough with those terms either.
Okay. Is she online? Representative Grunberg, question for Ms. Anderson?
Yeah. it has come to my attention, somebody has reminded me that when the bar disciplines people, one thing they can do is issue a public reprimand. And it would seem to me that the committee might consider having the power jurisdiction if they determine that the late filing was willful to issue a public reprimand. Do you have any thoughts on, as well as this?
I have thought about that, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm.
Because that's a very powerful deterrent, particularly for a politician.
What was it?
And, Mr. Chair, if I could ask for clarification, what exactly, Representative Grunberg, what do you mean by public reprimand?
Public reprimand is a reprimand that is officially given to the, in this case, the attorney, but there's also a little notice mm-hmm. that's published in the newspapers of general circulation around the state. And that, in and of itself, is far more of a deterrent than a few dollar fine. And I think that I would be prepared to offer such an amendment. If there was a fine, finding that the failure was willful, that would be a predicate. And that, secondly, that the committee would have to take a separate vote on both the fine and whether there should be a public reprimand.
Wow.
Mr. Chair, if I could comment on that. The committee has discussed this, and we do have in our rules of procedure that if this does occur, and it was in our advisor newsletter did list the information that this individual did not pay their fine. So in some respect, that was public, but not in the newspaper. The advisor newsletter is also on the website as well for anyone to take a look at. So that was noticed in that manner.
Mr. Chair.
We will finish this subject, and then Mr. Wayne is on the phone to answer Representative Grunberg and then Coghill.
I think I will offer such an amendment at the appropriate time. With the understanding that that would not just be in the newsletter, but it would be like the Bar Association.
Thank you. Representative Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, and if he offers the amendment, I will strongly object. I think the fact of a fine probably and the news of that fine is probably reprimand enough. But if we're going to get into disciplining members, that should be within the body. And I think to try to start moving then disciplinary action, even a reprimand outside of the body gets into dangerous ground. I'm always an advocate of giving only the right amount of authority to the Ethics Committee, and sometimes I think they've already got too much. So I think at this point I would not be willing to give one iota more authority. However, I want them to do what they do well.
Yes, and
so,
sure. And let's not forget the Fourth Estate, who is quite capable of undermining the reputation of members in good standing. Representative Lynn.
Well, in the case of the person I believe we're talking about, he is no longer in the body. So I don't know if that would apply. And secondly, in the case of an attorney who's a public recommend, reprimand, they may be trying to continue practicing law, but if you're not in the body seeking re-election or you're not in the campaign again, I don't know it makes any difference. I mean, somebody comes after me with something I allegedly did or didn't do and I'm not running for office, what opponent is going to put it on their campaign flyer?
Interesting. I think we'll await the amendment. Mr. Wayne, you're with us. Can you address Representative Samuel's concerns about the phrase municipality and what that word means, what it encompasses, please?
You're talking about, I'm sorry, I just got on the phone here, so.
Sorry, if you'd introduce yourself for the record, and then Representative Samuels will frame a question for you.
All right. My name is Dan Wayne. I'm a drafter in legislative legal.
Welcome, Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Wayne. On Section 1, on page 2 and 3 different places, lines 1, 10, and 16, the phrase municipality, does that encompass if a session, whether a regular session or a special session, were held in Fairbanks or North Pole or obviously Anchorage is a municipality, but even Juneau is a borough. Bethel is not incorporated at all. It's just a city. Does municipality incorporate any of those communities? I understand what the intent is, but does what you've written solve that concern that I've got, that just municipality doesn't incorporate boroughs or towns?
Well, definitions, the general definitions for the state of Alaska say that unless the context otherwise requires, municipality means a political subdivision incorporated under the laws of the state, a home rule or general law city, a home rule or general law borough, or a unified municipality.
Thank you.
Okay, we think you've satisfied our concern. Are there other questions for Ms. Anderson or for Mr. Wayne? And there is no public testimony, I don't believe. All right, public testimony is closed. The matter is back before the committee. Mr. Wayne, if you'll stay on the line, please. I'm going to offer amendment number one.
I'll object for discussion.
Representative Holmes objects for the purposes of discussion. And if the members will follow on the bill, it is a members of the immediate family, page 2, line 30. Insert a contribution to a charity event from any person at any time, and page 3, line 7, to delete or, so that it is both. Is that right, Joyce?
Delete or on line 7, yes.
Right, and since lines 8, 9, and 10 stay in the bill, then it just is.
Mr. Chairman, down below it adds two more, so the or drops down to subsection D. It's simply moving the or further down because it's adding
something. And then page 3, following line 10, oh, I see, the gift delivered. Accepted on behalf of a recognized non-political or compassionate gift. Okay, so I'm trying to think of what circumstances would be applicable to lines 12 through 14. If we had an event at the gymnasium, the Terry Miller in the Terry Miller Building, would that be a state?
Mr. Chair, if I could explain those amendments. First of all, on page 2, line 30, where we're inserting the words, a contribution to a charity event from any person at any time, that is currently in statute in two different places.
Okay.
That is in AS 2460-030-A2K and also 2460-080-C10.
Okay.
That was put in a couple years ago to deal with the Fahrenkamp Classic. And so what we're trying to do by adding that wording and D and E is to put all of the exemptions that are allowed from a lobbyist under one section so it's easily readable and so that you can take a look at it rather quickly and say, all right, these are all the exceptions from a lobbyist instead of looking in different parts of the statute. And then also D, which we're adding, is already in 2460-030-A2I. So basically, we're dragging them in from another part. We're not adding anything or changing anything.
And that's the note I have from Jane Pearson. This is language already in statute. We are just putting it in one area, or in this case, one more area, so that we don't have to chase through the statute. Is that accurate?
That's correct, okay. Mr. Chair.
All right. Is the objection maintained?
It is not.
The objection is removed. Amendment number one is passed. I have no more amendments. Do any of the members have additional amendments?
Yeah, I have
bill?
One here.
Representative Grunberg?
Maybe should we have this distributed?
Okay.
Basically, let me talk about it. As I discussed a minute ago, I think that the committee should also have the authority, if it finds that a late filing was willful, in addition to the fine or any fine that it may or may not impose, should have the authority to issue a private or a public reprimand. Private reprimand, meaning, as it is in the bar rules, would be simply a letter to the person involved, and that would be retained in the committee's files, a copy of that. A public reprimand would be the same as it is in the bar. There'd be a notice published in the newspaper in that same manner. And it's a conceptual amendment to respond to Representative Coghill's comments. It seems to me that just like with an attorney, and I think maybe, I don't know if the medical board can do this too, I think they can, and some of the other boards, but the person's reputation is extremely important, and I wouldn't anticipate this would be done very often. It would have to be a pretty egregious case, but that I think that the committee should have the authority to do that.
Okay. Representative Carco, would you? We have it before us. Would you like to move this as conceptual amendment number two?
Yeah.
And I'll object.
Conceptual amendment number two has been maintained. Representative Coghill has objected. Representative Gruenberg, I'd like to offer an amendment to the amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like for the alleged ethics to also be able to impose corporal punishment on any member, past or present, who doesn't file their paperwork in a timely method.
Would you be willing to take an amendment to your amendment that only applies if the member requests it?
No, but my point at sarcasm against the cautions of Representative Berkowitz, who told me that it translates poorly on the record, I think that corporal punishment is equally as inappropriate as a body like Ledge Ethics trying to tell the legislative body how to impose.
Before we continue with this punishing amendment, I'm going to withdraw it.
Okay, thank you.
I was originally going to say if the member comes from north of Palmer.
So the amendment to the amendment has been withdrawn. Conceptual amendment number two has been withdrawn. We have the CS for House Bill 368 Judiciary before us. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move the CS for House Bill number 368-25-LS1326-0 with an attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Thank you. And without objection, the CS for House Bill 368 moves from committee. It is 15 minutes past 3. Joyce, we thank you very much for attending. Final remarks?
I have one final comment. I would like to say that Senator Gary Stevens is on the Ethics Committee, and he has agreed to move this bill into the Senate. So I will let him know this afternoon yet that it has passed out of committee.
Thank you.
And he said he would be a sponsor for it in the Senate.
Thank you. Outstanding. Great. We appreciate that. And with that, we're adjourned.